Hello, I'm Representative Connie Bernardi, and welcome to the Higher Education Finance and Policy Committee in the Minnesota House of Representatives. Pursuant to House Rule 10.01, I call the remote meeting of the Higher Education Finance and Policy Committee to order. The committee legislative assistant will take the roll.
Chair Bernardi.
Present.
Bernardi, present. Vice Chair Christensen.
Present.
Christensen, present. Representative O'Neill.
Present.
O'Neill, present. Representative Albright.
Present.
Albright, present. Representative Daniels.
Present.
Daniels, present. Representative Erickson.
Present.
Erickson, present. Representative Hansen.
Hansen, present.
Hansen, present. Representative Heintzman. Representative Howard. Representative Keeler.
Present.
Keeler, present. Representative Cleavorn.
Cleavorn, present.
Cleavorn, present. Representative Kosnick.
Kosnick, present.
Kosnick, present. Representative Kresha. Representative Mason.
Mason, present.
Mason, present. Representative Meckland.
Meckland, present.
Meckland, present. Representative Knorr. Representative Sandell.
Present.
Sandell, present. Representative Sandsted.
Sandsted, present.
Sandsted, present. Representative Thompson.
Thompson, present.
Thompson, present. Representative Heintzman. Representative
Heintzman, present.
Heintzman, present. Representative Howard.
Present.
Howard, present. Representative Kresha. And Representative Knorr. And a quorum is present, Madam Chair.
Thank you. May I have a motion to approve the minutes of March 23rd, 2021?
So moved, Madam Chair.
Representative Stanstead moves approval of the minutes for March 23rd. Any discussion? Please take off your mutes momentarily. All those in favor, hearing no discussion, all those in favor say aye.
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 Those opposed? The motion prevails and the minutes for March 23rd, 2021 are approved. Members, we have three bills before us today. First, we'll hear a short presentation from Dr. Bruce Corey on the higher education recommendations from the Select Committee of Racial Justice. And then we will take up House File 2393 from Representative Mariani, House File 1895 from Representative Sansed, and finally House File 2205 from Representative Danny. We will give each author a chance to introduce their bill, followed by additional testimony, and then we will have time for member discussion and questions. And we have a lot to accomplish today, so we will be on a time-specific schedule. Members, I have invited Dr. Corey back to our committee to join us and share the recommendations by the Select Committee on Racial Justice with our committee before we have a larger discussion with Representative Mariani and the team from the Minnesota Education Equity Partnership on House File 2393. Welcome to the committee, Dr. Corey. Please introduce yourself and begin your presentation.
Thank you, Chair Bernardi, Vice Chair Christensen, and Peter O'Neill for the honor to present to this committee. My name is Dr. Bruce Corey from Concordia University. I am honored that to share the recommendations of Chair Moran and Richardson on the House Select Committee on Racial Justice, with the focus on the recommendations on higher education. I want to acknowledge the leadership of the House and this committee for focusing on an important aspect of our society, and that is the systemic racism and its impact economic impact and more wider impact on our communities. And I want to focus on the core recommendations of the House Select Committee on Racial Justice. So the committee maintains that racism is a system, not an individual character flaw or a personal moral failing. It is a system of power that structures opportunity, such as education, housing, jobs, and justice, and assigns value, worthy or unworthy, full of potential or full of menace, based on so-called race, the social interpretation of how we look. And the conclusion after this deliberation of the Select Committee on Racial Justice was that systemic racism exists, systemic racism is harmful, and systemic racism must be addressed. And I provided to the committee testimony that if you, the cumulative economic cost of racism is an estimated $287 billion, and the state loses in tax revenue about $2 billion. And the reverse of it, the benefits would happen if we close these gaps. So some of the recommendations of the House Select Committee on Racial Justice was the increased investing in recruiting, training, retaining and promoting teachers of colors and indigenous teachers through programs such as scholarship and loan forgiveness programs, grow your own pathway grants, career pathways, implement stipends for mentors, teachers, and paid student teaching opportunities, increased funding for youth apprenticeships and work experiences, mandated training for around a cultural intelligence and responsive learning environment, protection of teachers of colors and indigenous teachers to improve retention rates, hiring and an increase of school support professionals such as school counselors, social workers, behavioral specialists, psychologists and nurses, increased access to dual credit and rigorous courses in high school for all students, not just high achieving students, improving access to free post-secondary remedial classes, increasing investments in tutoring for college students, providing tuition-free community college for students with financial needs, and developing emergency funding for a program for post-secondary students. And may I suggest that if we place these various recommendations, they would fall in these four big categories of affordability, academic career and support services, cultural intelligence and responsive learning environment, including the power structures in these environments, and then a focus on academic and career outcomes. And if you keep in mind this framework, we would be able to offer a comprehensive set of programs for our students. I would like to add that Minnesota Gaines, for example, if you look at the 2013 cohort, if all of the BIPOC students graduated in 4 years, Minnesota's tax revenue would have increased by $1.5 billion in terms of this increased tax revenues and reduced government costs. But that did not happen because all of the students did not graduate. And there are tremendous amount of positives that come out of the investments in a four-year degree, such as the reduction in poverty, the greater likelihood of having high health insurance, the greater likelihood of having a retirement plan, the probability of being employed is higher, life expectancy increases, the probability of being in prison or jail goes down, volunteering improves, and civic engagement increases significantly. And most of all, there's an increased trust that occurs in the community. So I want to present very quickly an overview of the recommendations, and I thank you for this opportunity to do so.
We'll say that again. Thank you, Dr. Corey, for your presentation today. We appreciate you serving on this committee and making this presentation to us today. Thank you very much. We are now going to move into the Higher Education State Grant Program parameters. They've been modified, and the state grant Well, actually, I'll let Representative Mariani tell you that. But I will move House File 2393 to be laid over for possible inclusion. We have before us House File 2393. Representative Mariani, please tell us about your bill and welcome to our committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's a pleasure to be here. It's my first stop this session in this committee. So thank you for you and the members for the hearing on House File 2393. I'm going to give you just a very quick two-minute, sort of 50-foot level view. Then I'm going to turn to my colleagues here to talk a little bit more in detail in terms of the proposal. Before you, I do want to say it's a privilege to follow Dr. Corey. I'm a big fan of Dr. Corey for many, many years, and I've had the privilege of working with him on race equity issues during that time. And in many ways, the Select Committee's frameworks are very consistent with the bill that we've brought before you. This proposal is the result of a two-year engagement and research initiative being conducted by the 30-year nonprofit People of Color-led organization that I lead, the Minnesota Education Equity Partnership, or MNEEP. The initiative involves a diverse collection of representatives from communities of color, educational institutions, and higher education systems, and ranges from students to college presidents. I believe Minnesota needs to do more than tinker around the edges of our state's education delivery system. MNEP contends that our state works under an older finance and student support design that is becoming increasingly out of step with what today's students need to be successful. In other words, with what Minnesota's social and economic sectors need to be successful. This is especially acute given that our approach needs to better align with the realities of our Black, Latino, Asian, and American Indian students, a rapidly increasing source of our state's best economic and social future. Newer research and evidence-based practice points to major approaches we can be using to meet our statutory goals for college completion that includes closing racial gaps in outcomes and provide better opportunities for students. To do this, it is important, we believe, to simultaneously address the financial and the student support elements that should be central to any successful delivery of higher ed opportunities. That's what this bill does in proposing the first steps to a new higher learning compact for our state. Time is a critical resource for the successful pursuit of higher education credentials. Our financial aid system must maximize students' ability to focus time on their studies. Rigor is also a critical resource for the successful pursuit of higher education credentials. Student engagement must maximize exposure to credit-bearing, high-quality content coursework. Real-world assessment of student academic needs is a critical resource for the successful pursuit of higher ed credentials. Multiple measures beyond one-size-fits-all testing tools and approaches properly direct students to meet their aspirations. And finally, student empowerment is a critical resource for the successful pursuit of higher education credentials. Institutional practices that align with a student's cultural strengths pragmatically maximizes student success. These are the principles that guide this proposal, and here to present how these principles for success are advanced in the bill are my colleagues at MNEP, Leah Thea, Dr. John Peterson, Jennifer Godinez, and Dr. Sandy Pullis and Megan Rosowski.
Thank you, Representative Mariani. We will begin with Jennifer Godinez, and welcome to the committee. Please state your name.
Thank you, Chair Bernardi. I'm Jennifer Godinez, G-O-D-I-N-E-Z, and I'm with the Minnesota Education Equity Partnership. I'll just have a couple more words to add to Representative Mariani's statement around MNEEP. We are a 30-year organization. It's very proud to have been influenced by cultural communities and leaders in Minnesota that felt that our systems have to go beyond diversity and actually understand the interests of cultural communities. So we have very deep relationships in Native American communities statewide, the Latino community statewide, African American, African immigrants, Asian, and low-income students in general. And just to really emphasize our race equity lens that we use on systems reform, we really feel that the historical inequities that exist in the United States and in Minnesota have to be taken into account as we're looking at K-12 and higher education, new funding investments. So a racial equity lens really looks at that historical debt that we owe those communities and modernizes, has a more updated conversation on what policies and practices need to shift. I'm so proud to work with the colleagues that you'll hear from today because we shaped up a policy brief more than 18 months ago that really used that race equity lens to look at the higher ed finance system in Minnesota to, again, modernize it and reach the state's goals of the higher ed attainment level of 70%. So you all have set a 70% attainment goal for each cultural community by 2025. We know that the communities of color and American Indian communities and students are ready to meet that goal, and we would just like to propose recommendations to advance, as Representative Mariani has stated, both the financial policies and also the systems approach and the practices to better serve our students of color. I'll pass it on to my colleagues. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Now we have with us Dr. Robert John Peterson. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Excuse me. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Mariani and Ms. Godinez, for your comments. I really appreciate hearing from you both and having you both here. Before I get started, I'd just like to quickly thank all of the partners who have been involved in this work over the past 2 years and even over the last 15 years as the Minnesota Education Equity Partnership has been leading race equity work in higher education. So thank you to everyone who's been involved with the project.
Dr. Peterson, can you please state your name for the record and your organization? That would be great.
I'm sorry,
Madam I forgot to ask you. Thank you.
Oh, that's okay, Madam Chair. My name is Leah Tawa, Dr. Robert John Peterson, and I am a program fellow with the Minnesota Education Equity Partnership. So what I'd like to do in the next few minutes, just a couple, 2-3 minutes, is to quickly go through the recommendations. There are 10. The first broadly relates to the Office of Higher Education collecting data and reporting on students who withdraw from public post-secondary, i.e. stopping out without the completion of a degree or a credential. We would like that the data be disaggregated by race, ethnicity, Pell eligibility, and age, and updated annually and presented and made available on the OHE, Office of Higher Ed website. The second recommendation is to reduce the assigned student responsibility for the state grant program from 50%, which is current, to 46% of the cost of attendance. The third recommendation relates to living and miscellaneous expenses and increasing the allowance from 106% of federal poverty guidelines to 150%. We'd also like to note that the governor's higher education bill, HF 993, increases this amount to 110%. We feel we're moving in the similar direction with the governor's proposal. Four provides that developmental education courses not count against the student state grant aid or state grant aid award cap for credits taken. The governor's higher education bill, again, HF 993, has this same proposal. The bill also proposes expanding state grant eligibility from 8 to 10 semesters or equivalent, which would change from 120 credit hours to 150 credit hours. That is also part of the policy brief recommendations. The fifth recommendation is to require state colleges or universities to both check on and provide a student prior to enrolling in a developmental education course a direct notification if the student's ACT, SAT, or MCA score exempts them from being required to take a developmental education course or courses. That would be based on college-ready benchmark scores on those three assessments. And that is already linked into current state statute. We're just asking that students be notified in a timely and meaningful way about their exemption based on those college-ready benchmark scores. 6, requiring state colleges and universities to use multiple measures, not solely testing alone, but providing them with the opportunity to use additional multiple measures when determining whether or not a student should be in developmental education. 7 is to reduce the 75% amount of non-credit developmental education courses system-wide by the start of the fall 2025 academic term. We propose also that the Minnesota State Board of Trustees report to the Minnesota Legislature beginning August 1st of 2022, progress made in phasing out non-credit developmental education courses. The 8th recommendation is to require the Office of Higher Education to conduct a study relating to the analysis and expansion of work-study programming by January 15th, 2022, and report out on the results of that study. Number 9 is to appropriate an amount to be determined by the Minnesota Legislature to the Board of Trustees of Minnesota State to create challenge grants to system campuses to pursue innovations in student transfer, shorten time to degree completion, and minimize the accumulation of excess credits. And then the 10th and final recommendation is to appropriate an amount to be determined by the Minnesota Legislature to the Office of Higher Education to provide for grants to post-secondary institutions to train faculty and staff in culturally responsive teaching and anti-racist teaching practices. The bill also proposes that the commissioner shall report to the legislature on the results of the grant program, including information about the funded projects and their outcomes. That concludes the 10 recommendation and points laid out in the bill. Madam Chair.
Thank you, Dr. Peterson. And Representative Mariani, did you have any other testifiers that you were going to have today, or people are they here to answer questions?
Yeah, I have Dr. Polis and Ms. Rosowski, and we thought the best way to economize our time is to make them available to answer questions. They are the co-chairs of the advisory group that has been working this initiative and directing the construct of the proposal before you. So they're wonderful resources as we get into question and answers and on the bill itself.
Thank you very much. And then we have someone who is here to provide public testimony that has signed up, which is Matt Williams, the president of the Minnesota I'll let him introduce himself. Sorry. Go ahead. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Williams.
It's good to be back, Madam Chair. Chair Bernardi, Vice Chair Christensen, members of the committee, thank you for having me this afternoon. For the record, my name is Dr. Matt Williams, he, him. I am an English instructor at Inverhills Community College and currently serving as the president of the Minnesota State College faculty. I'm here today to offer testimony related to House File 2393, not just as a researcher and scholar in the area of writing instruction, but as the president of the unionized faculty at all tier colleges here in Minnesota. As MSCF, we believe every student, regardless of who they are, where they come from, or what they have been through, has a right to experience the positive, transformative effects of education. We believe this because we know it makes our state better for all of us. And we know it is our collective responsibility to support this essential public good. While we believe the creators of this bill share this vision of high quality learning for all, right now we cannot support this bill in its current state. It's important to understand that developmental education isn't just a type of a class, it is an active area of inquiry rooted in a simple question. How do we ensure all students can succeed when students start from such different places and trajectories? Over the past 50 years, educators and scholars have sought to answer and re-answer this question, creating a wide variety of structures, curricula, and programs. What we have learned is that no one single idea works universally, and no successful idea lasts forever. Our concern with this bill, as it currently is written, is that at least in the area of developmental education, it doesn't build on the hard-won knowledge of educators regarding the barriers we have encountered and how to best support this work. Instead, it approaches developmental education in a one-size-fits-all approach. And I believe we can improve this because educators have an unparalleled view of what is needed to support this work. And I believe there is an incredible opportunity for partnership here. We've already reached out to the author of this bill, and I really look forward to working on this important area together, both with Representative Mariani and the rest of MNEEP. Thank you for your time and the opportunity to speak with you today.
Thank you. And we do have member questions, and we will start with Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this is an interesting bill, to say the least. But I have a question for Mr. Williams. Madam Chair, is that okay?
Yeah. Oh, yes. Please proceed, Representative Erickson.
So, Mr. Williams, I was really intrigued by your testimony now about developmental courses. And since I'm a retired K-12 high school teacher and serve on all the education committees here in the House, I'm thinking that it's more a responsibility of the K-12 system to ensure that a student is ready for college and career based on, you know, what we have in law presently. Would you comment on that?
Mr. Williams.
Absolutely, Madam Chair and Representative Erickson. I think when we think about, excuse me, I have dogs squeaking on toys over here. When we talk about success for students, I think it's everyone shares this responsibility equally. I feel often, or far too often, we are asked to pit K-12 against higher ed and higher ed against K-12, when in fact, this is a common cause that we all have to be thinking about. How do we best support our students? We know in our K-12 educational system that not everyone gets an equal education, and that means that we have an equal responsibility to address those things. So I think it's a yes and question. Absolutely, we need to support our K-12 educators. They have an important role to play in this, but it's not just their responsibility. I think it really belongs to all of us. Thank you for the question.
Representative Erickson, do you have a follow-up?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Mr. Williams, for that answer, because I think that is the better answer, that we need to work cooperatively. And, you know, we do have in law certain parameters over which selection can be made for enrollment in a particular post-secondary institution. So I think we need to pay closer attention to that at the back end and the front end. So thank you very much.
Representative Mariani, did you have something to add?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Just two things quickly. I'm going to call my colleagues to talk more about this, because this is an important point. First of all, let me just say, in many ways, there's a bit of an old dichotomy here, you know, where one system points at the other system and says, hey, not my problem. You know, you should have done better. You should do better. You know, and moralistically, that's probably true. The problem with that conversation is that whole communities continue to be left behind by both systems. And what doesn't get created is the space and the innovation for us to do better than what we're currently doing, and to use indeed evidence-based practices, good research, to be able to inform that. And so that's why I want to call on my colleagues to talk very quickly about this issue. The proposals before you are in fact based on good research-based evidence, where we hope and really want to drive things like co-requisite remedials, and perhaps that's where Dr. Williams and us can pretty excitingly, you know, arrive at some really good movement forward. But Madam Chair, let me call, if it'd be okay, I'd like to call on my colleagues to do that.
And which colleague would you like to me to call on?
Well, let me start with Dr. Peterson, then he can ask his colleagues, whoever he thinks is the best.
Yep. Okay. Dr. Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Mariani. I think there are a couple of issues to consider with respect to developmental education. On the whole, this bill does not state that we should totally eliminate developmental education. There are instances where developmental education is appropriate. What we would like to see are two pieces relative to developmental education. One is that developmental education, also known as remedial, be made free to the student and not cost against their state grant aid, and or that the developmental education course could be considered as a credit toward a degree for completion of a degree, a two-year degree. Another aspect of the developmental education conversation rests with the research. one of the problems with the assessment, the Accuplacer, that is used to place students into developmental education is that the assessment is not, to my knowledge, been correlated nor aligned to the MCA assessments and the state standards in Minnesota. This is problematic at a student level because oftentimes I've heard as a former high school administrator that the Accuplacer does not measure what the students have been taught in high school based on the MCAs and the standards. That's one issue. A second issue is that the Community College Resource Center from Teachers College of Columbia since 2012 has been conducting research on the predictive validity of the Accuplacer assessment as well as the ACT. And what they found in the research is that there's a pretty high percentage for students to be over-identified for developmental education because those assessments lack the validity and the reliability to accurately place students into developmental education 95 to 100% of the time. And so the two proposals that we put forward, which again were number 6, which relates to multiple measures, and number 7, which relates to reducing developmental education, really work in tandem. And we think that if we could use multiple measures, we could more accurately place students into developmental ed and also provide opportunities to use research-based and evidence-based practices that other states like Texas have been using for a number of years. Tennessee is another example, to access co-requisite remedial courses to be used in tandem with developmental education. Lastly, I'll say that I'm very encouraged by the comments by Mr. Williams about the opportunity to partner with that group, the faculty union, to ensure that we are doing this in a way that is based on best practices and supports both students and faculty in higher ed. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. We have Representative Albright has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mariana, it's good to see you in committee. We note that I think it was just last week, House File 1517, Representative Howard is the chief author on that. He also talked about a decrease, in the state grant calculator. His dropped it down to 47%. Your proposal drops it down to 46%. There is also already a fiscal note achieving about a $43 million investment there. What do you hope to derive from dropping it one more percent? And I have a follow-up, Madam Chair.
Representative Mariani.
Well, Madam Chair, I'd call on Ms. Mosrowski to talk about how we got to, what's the principle behind that? Although I suspect the question has to do with why not 47 as opposed to 46? We're both moving in the right direction, and really is my ultimate answer. But in terms of the why, if I can call quickly on Ms. Rosowski to do a quick response, that'd be helpful, Madam Chair.
Ms. Rosowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Albright. In the analysis that
Please state your name for the record. Thank you.
Sorry. My name is Megan Rosowski. I'm the Director of Research at the Minnesota Private College Council, and I'm the co-chair of the CREAC. So thank you for your question. When we were analyzing how to make college more affordable for students and in particular students of color and Indigenous students, we wanted to find a way to change the state grant program so that students could attend college and pay their share through reasonable amounts of work and borrowing. Students really shouldn't be working more than 10 to 15 hours a week. Otherwise, it's correlated with a decrease in retention and graduation rates. So this also aligns with some work from the Office of Higher Education that analyzed what would make college affordable for students in Minnesota. And the real goal over the long term is to lower the student share down to 36 or 38%. The Office of Higher Education says 36%. Our calculation is 38%. So we were looking at this as an incremental approach over time, and we're looking at a decrease at 4 percentage points at this time. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Albright.
you, Madam Chair, and to whomever would wish to answer this question. I drop back to the results that we've heard, I think, at the onset of the session in this committee, and I've heard it in others. But I get the impression, and Representative Mariani, you can certainly persuade me otherwise, that the only meaningful way to achieve success in life is by a four-year degree. The perception on my part, and certainly just mine if that's the case, that we are persuading everyone to look towards a four-year degree. And certainly these principles and proposals persuade me to believe that way. Why would we not also consider very strongly areas such as the trades, cybersecurity, those law enforcement and others that may not require a full investment in a four-year degree, but literally get us on that career highway, career interstate. And as you roll down the highway, you can take off ramps from time to time to, metaphorically speaking, put more gas in your tank and get back on that interstate highway for the same career path, or you can deviate and choose a different path or a different highway. Would appreciate your comments to that, Representative.
Yep. Representative Mariani.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Very quickly, and then I'd like to call Dr. Pulis. Yes, and I think Representative Albright identifies or articulates the many ways in which our society and our economy, through post-secondary credentialing, can enhance the lives of all its citizens at the same time that it enhances our community life. But I would be remiss if I did not acknowledge that in our estimation, there is a disturbing gap when it comes to those 2-4-year degree credentials. We need to address that as well. That goes to the issue of even simple things like who gets to make decisions in our society, who occupies those positions of advanced management, et cetera. But in no way should, in my opinion, should this be a either or proposition. The proposition here is to expand what happens for opportunities in post-secondary. Madam Chair, if I can call on Dr. Pulis really quickly to add to that.
Dr. Pulis, please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Dr. Sandy Pulis, and I work at Serve Minnesota as the Vice President of Equity and Inclusion. And thank you, Representative Albright, for your question. And I would just add that our goal here really is to align strategies in terms of having students, BIPOC students in particular, close those achievement gaps that we've seen and those opportunity gaps in higher education. We know that there's the 2025 attainment goal set in higher education, and we certainly want to make sure that any strategies that we are putting forth are in alignment with that attainment goal. We certainly are not suggesting that a four-year degree is what all students need. We really are focusing on ensuring that students have access and the support systems in place to access and attain those degrees. Thank you.
Madam Chair, if I could just follow up on that with one quick question.
Representative Albright, and then,
thank you,
yes.
Madam Chair. Representative Mariani, I think it's the ninth proposal with regard to the challenge grant for increasing degree completion. I apologize if I'm reading this wrong, but it reads to me like, and I'm paraphrasing, obviously, it appears to me as if what we are doing with that proposal is that we are offering financial incentive for our institutions to talk to one another about how to transfer credits and or avail students to move more freely between the systems, whether they Minsku, University of Minnesota, the private colleges or what have you, seems to me that they should be taking that up on their own and trying to provide that through their own systems, as opposed to laying out kind of a carrot to make that happen, when ordinarily wouldn't that be happening already, or shouldn't it be happening already out of the budgetary confines that they already find themselves in? Thank you.
Representative Mariani.
Madam Chair, Representative Aubrey, good question. I think some of it that is happening, what we want to do is really accelerate that that process and really provide a strong directive and expectation from the legislature for our systems to truly be those centers of urgent innovation. But I'm wondering if Dr. Peterson might want to add a few words to that as well.
Dr. Peterson.
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, thank you for the question. I'll be brief in my comments. One of the things that we learned coming out of the Great Recession of the late 2000s is that targeted and strategic investments that support the piloting of innovative programs, such as those found in the Investing in Innovation Program, otherwise known as the I3 program, can, as Representative Mariani has stated, accelerate innovation in a piloted format in the areas of how to improve student transfer experiences and tighten that pipeline, to identify strategies to help students who have stopped out get back into the pipeline toward degree completion and workforce. And so what we've found in the research in some of the other states, like Tennessee, Texas, and other places, is that targeted, strategic, and generally small challenge grants can help to stimulate innovation through pilot that can be used as a means for providing an evidence base that can scale up and accelerate degree completion for all students. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Howard.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Mariani, and to the testifiers. I note that this proposal referring to the state grant makes changes both to the student responsibility and to the living and miscellaneous expenses. And I wonder, from an equity perspective, from an equity lens, do you, Representative Mariani, or testifiers have thoughts about one of these levers or the other in terms of its impact from an equity perspective? With limited resources, do you have guidance for this committee in terms of where we should be investing our dollars as we hopefully bolster the state grant program looking at these two buckets?
Representative Mariani, would you like to answer? I do see that Dr. Peterson would like to answer as well.
Yeah, you know, Representative Howard always asks all those tough questions, and actually your whole committee does, but yeah, let me turn over to, it sounds like Dr. Peterson wants to take a game right there.
Dr. Peterson. Oh, you're on mute. There you go.
Madam Chair, I apologize. I hit the wrong button. I hit the take down my hand button. So thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Howard. As Ms. Godinez and as Representative Mari have indicated, we use the racial equity lens and a race equity framework to develop each of the 10 recommendations. We acknowledge and recognize the limited resources that are made available to this committee and the chair. What I would put forward is that you have before you a menu of options, any of which could help to support all students, and specifically BIPOC and POSSE students, to be more successful in completing college and getting into workforce to support the socioeconomic needs and the racial justice needs of the state of Minnesota. And so I would put it forward to you, Representative Howard, and your colleagues and the chair, that you explore the menu of options and pick the things that work best for you all as a committee. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Howard, did you have a follow-up?
No, Madam Chair, okay. Thank you.
Seeing no further hands, Representative Mariani, would you like to say some closing remarks?
Yeah, Madam Chair, thank you for the conversation. I really appreciate that from you and from the committee members. I do want to thank my colleagues at MNEP. You know, I just want to acknowledge that, you know, Minnesota has had a historical commitment to post-secondary, but also specifically to this issue of making it financially realistic and possible for just your regular Minnesotan, obviously everyone, but just regular folks to be able to pursue their desires, realize their dreams through advanced education. But, you know, I don't think we'll get a lot of argument in this committee or probably even the legislature that's really slipped over the years. And the challenge becomes bigger now because it's slipped at the same time that our society has gotten increasingly diverse, and which means that there's all sorts of assumptions that have been built into our original design that need to be rethought and tested so that, in fact, we do have systems that align as closely as possible with the realities, the real impacts that students and their families and their communities face on a daily basis that either can help drive them through post-secondary or that hinders their opportunity to get through post-secondary. I do think it's important that as we go forward with this committee's work and the legislature's work, that we don't in fact tinker around the edges. And by that, what I meant is that we resist the urge to just do one thing. There really is a synergy between how we support students as well as the financial possibilities that we help make possible for them. You can do a great job. We can do a great job of providing financial access, but boy, if those student supports aren't there, we're not necessarily doing everything that we can be doing. I'm really pleased that some of the governor's proposals are pushing and acknowledging this and pushing in the same direction. I know from conversations with members from both sides of the aisle that lots of folks here have asked the same kind of questions and are trying to figure out, so how do we innovate into the next sort of 21st century approach to post-secondary? And so it's really in the spirit of all that that we've proposed this bill before you. And I hope and encourage you to embrace it as you move forward with your omnibus bill this year. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you to the members for this conversation, this opportunity.
Thank you, Representative Mariani, and to our testifiers today. I will renew my motion that House File 2393 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Higher Education Finance Omnibus Bill. The bill is laid over. Next, we have House File 1895 from Representative Stanstead. Representative Stanstead, would you like to move your bill to get it before the committee?
I would, Madam Chair.
Representative Stanstead will move House File 1895 to be laid over for possible inclusion. We have before us House File 1895. Representative Stanstead, please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. House File 1895 is a very straightforward bill that appropriates $10 million each of the next 2 years to the University of Minnesota's Duluth Natural Resource Research Institute and their applied research and economic for their applied research and economic development efforts. I want to be very clear at the beginning of this that this ask is intended to be additional money to the University of Minnesota for NRRI and not in lieu of or in competition with the university's budget ask. In February, the legislature learned that the state would be facing a $1.6 billion surplus rather than a deficit. We've also recently learned that over $552 million would be coming from the federal government for higher education relief. In the short time that I've been in the legislature, I've become a huge fan of NRRI, and I am convinced that their work is pivotal in providing solutions for many of the environmental concerns the state is trying to address and resolve, as well as having the potential to bring tremendous statewide economic gains through the work that they're doing around economies of the future. As legislators, we're tasked with investing dollars in ways that yield great returns. Investing now in NRRI with some of these one-time monies will go a long way in advancing the work of the Institute, and we all stand to benefit from these investments. Furthermore, when the techniques currently being studied around iron of the future comes to fruition, the university itself and students stand to benefit from any royalties that are currently being used towards endowment and statewide scholarships. On January 26, this committee heard President Joan Gable refer to NRRI as one of the university's best kept secrets. I don't think NRRI should be kept a secret any longer, but rather we should make the investments that are needed now and into the future to position the Institute as a leader statewide and globally. At this time, I would like to turn my presentation over to Dr. Rolf Weberg, who will tell you a little bit about who NRRI is and the work that they do. Following his presentation, Madam Chair, I would like to share a few more facts with the committee, if you could allow that.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Weberg. Please state your name for the committee.
Thank you, Chair Bernardi. My name is Rolf Weberg. I'm the Executive Director at the Natural Resources Research Institute at the University of Minnesota. I'd like to start out by thanking you for the opportunity to speak with you today to give you a background and an overview of NRRI. It's the worst acronym to have to say quickly, but it's also something that when I do give a tour of the place, it usually takes 2 hours. So I'm going to give you a very quick overview of what we do, why we do it, how we do it, and who we do it with. As background, I'm about 7 years old at the University of Minnesota. Prior to that, I was with the DuPont company in the research division and left there as a global technology manager in building innovations, and then took this job working with a fantastic group of people at the University of Minnesota. So I'm going to share my screen, not to give you death by PowerPoint, but to hopefully direct the conversation to a good discussion. Hopefully you can see my screen at this point in time. Okay, thank you. So what I'd like to do today is talk a little bit about what Natural Resources Research Institute is here for and why we do our work. We drive innovative research for the state of Minnesota, and that this is applied research. It has to be of global relevance or it's probably not worth doing. And that Minnesota value in the middle of the screen there, Minnesota has much value in our natural resources, but Minnesotans have value for their resources. And we work right in that juxtaposition of driving good decisions for the state of Minnesota. So we are an applied research, economic development, and commercialization engine within the University of Minnesota. We have long-term relationships with institutions across the country, agencies, businesses, and industry. We drive collaborative partnerships, which is what we like to really focus on. We work with people in partnership, whether it's within university, other academic units, government agencies, NGOs, and our state citizens. Starting at the beginning, which is usually a good place to start, NRRI was created by the legislature for the legislature. And you can see by reading the charter that was provided in 1983, it really has a economic development mission, as well as a environmental stewardship mission and a mission to create employment for the state of Minnesota. Our mission statement as a result of that is really the first four words are dear to me. Deliver is important. If we're not delivering, we're not doing our job. But the idea of an integrated research solution is really about talking about no silos, groups of people working together to solve problems and deliver solutions that are much more comprehensive than an answer. We do that from a position of knowing the data, which is valuing our resource environment and the economy for both a sustainable and resilient future, because if we don't, sustainability is wonderful and we have to be working toward that, but if we can't be resilient to global changes, we don't have an economy. At the end of the day, we work together to discover that economy of the future. We are here to help do that. We partner with partners all over the state and country to do so. So we offer 5 research platforms. This is why people come to us to work. We have some of the top water and forestry scientists in the country. One sits on the EPA advisory panel. The other, another sits on the governor's climate change committee. If we know the world we live in, we can do a much better job of understanding and taking care of it. Minerals and metallurgy, NRI is the center for minerals research in this part of the country. That's a pretty significant claim. In terms of materials and bioeconomy, looking forward to what can we do with our biomass resources, whether they're forest or other related, to create materials for the future beyond paper and our lumber industry. How do we convert some of these industries into that economy of the future? Data collection and delivery, how do we present information to legislators and other decision makers that's easy to understand in the form of a map? We have key capabilities in doing that, and we can, I'm sure some of you have already seen some of those products. And finally, what we're pretty happy about and excited about is driving the commercialization services across the state as part of the University of Minnesota's effort called Launchpad, where we help entrepreneurs build businesses out of their ideas. The picture, they say, is worth 1,000 words, and I think it's really worth pointing out here, is this is a picture of our Coleraine site. We go from the test tube to the ton. And this is really important because when you are talking about industrial investment, industry and business investment really depends on reduction of risk. And by being able, this is our biomass conversion laboratory that you're seeing that picture there. By being able to go into high volume, we can really actually model a successful industry and business, and it makes it much more useful to investment. We have 2 major research facilities in the state. One on the left is the Duluth facility, which is a great place to be in a tornado. It was built originally as the control point for the SAGE system that was looking for the Russians coming over the ice cap back in the Cold War. That's where we have our administrative groups and all of our key and environmental and research laboratories. The Coleraine site that you see on the left is in Representative Sandstead's district is a 27-acre industrial lab that used to belong to U.S. Steel, where we do all of our minerals work, as well as our biomass processing and energy processing. These assets alone represent over $75 million in capital investment alone, not counting all the equipment and the people and the knowledge. So it's quite an asset to the state. If you don't remember anything else, this is what we do. We understand our resources from A to Z, both ends of the pipe, if you will. We are looking to diversify our product portfolio, keep more of that money in the state, invest it in the state, invest it in our people and our students. I'm actually a product of that. I was a University of Minnesota student, left the state and came back. So it's a pleasure to be here. Converting waste to value opportunities. Waste is simply bad business. How do we turn that around? And again, offer more opportunity and embrace life cycle thinking, because if we don't own all 3 sides of that dice, we're lying to each other in terms of creating those good decisions for that economy of the future. So I'm going to close with one last slide that's a little bit of an eye chart, but I hope it really speaks to you in terms of how we look at the integrated delivery of these projects and products around the state. I'm just going to highlight a couple of these as I walk through. In our climate change and resource management, the Natural Resources Atlas is now a statewide tool that with support from the legislature, NRI has spent about $1.3 million. Outside estimates go up to $15 million in order to do this kind of work, where any one of you can look at the, go to the website, download any part of the state you're interested in looking at, and you can look at anything from hiking trails to waters of concern to mineral opportunities to timber opportunities to infrastructure and demographics. Over 300 databases all at your fingertips. And this was actually at the behest of the legislature. When we go into the water quality, I'll call out sulfate. Sulfate is a statewide challenge. is particularly important in northern Minnesota, where we have the wild rice standards. We are deploying portable units to go out and test low capex, low opex opportunities for not only water treatment facilities, but also industrial treatment facilities that utilize new technologies, including our friends, the microbes. We also, when we look at some of our other technology, you'll see in the bioeconomy, using some of our wood waste materials, we're developing new technologies to address nutrient reduction in our agricultural districts, namely phosphorus and nitrogen. The same technology is being used to address PFAS, that is a problem in the southern part of the state, but has also just been detected in Lake Superior smelt this last spring. E. coli, heavy metals, harmful algal blooms, these are all challenges that NRI is engaging across the state to bring solutions and new ideas forward. Forests and land, you can see those carbon sequestration and storage is a big conversation. How do we manage our forests so we can do the best job using those to sequester carbon for the state? As we talk to business and industry, decarbonization is a big conversation that we're having across the board. Our minerals industry is looking for advanced mineral processing technology that allows us to create higher value products, as well as address using waste materials that actually find their way into nutrient reduction and water quality applications. So we're looking for these integrated opportunities. And finally, when we look at the bioeconomy work, how do we use our woody biomass? Right now, we're working with a number of beetle-killed tree opportunities across the state, and Twin Cities has a lot of that challenge, of course. And secondary species utilization in the northern part of the state, which offers some forest fire protection. But what do we do with that material by converting it into higher value carbon products, namely things like biochar and other higher value activated carbon type products? It takes a waste material that we're burying and letting generate CO2 and turning it into a carbon sequestration material that actually has secondary performance in terms of absorbing materials out of the environment. So I hope that gives you a very high spot fast summary of how we do our work, what we're focused on. We have a statewide stance. We work across the board with our partners, both across the state and across the country. And I'll thank you for your attention, and I'll offer you a red carpet anytime any of you feel to come and visit us. It'd be a real honor to show you what we do. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And we have four member questions, and we'll be able to give each member one question depending how long the time for the response. So hopefully we will get through all of our member questions before we move on to the next bill. So Representative Sandell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Sandell and Dr. Weberg. I can't wait to vote for this bill. I've accepted an invitation 2 years ago to visit NRRI, and coincidentally, I was there along with President Gable, her husband, and Majority Leader Winkler and his son. It was a remarkable morning and afternoon for us. For those of us who are interested in protecting and enhancing our environment, this is a place that we ought to cherish. For those of us who are interested in endorsing and embracing and developing our industry and the way that it reaches around the world, this is a place that we ought to be looking for help. And for those of us who admire and are excited about the concentration of brilliant at the University of Minnesota, this is a place we should be proud of. I couldn't be more enthusiastic about the work they do. Representative Sandstead and Rolf and I have spoken about this at length, and I couldn't be more enthusiastic about the work. And for those of you who haven't been up there, it's really a remarkable opportunity. And for a chance to vote for this bill is really a pleasure for me. So thank you, Representative Sandstead and Dr. Weber. Thank you.
Representative O'Neill, and then we have Representative Albright, and then Representative Erickson on deck. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I have toured up at the Duluth site as well. My questions are not about the value of this particular site, but I want to remind authors that come to a finance committee, when you have a $4 million base appropriation and you're asking for $20 million on top of that, and you don't even talk about the financial, what you would use that money for, I am just immensely disappointed. I don't disagree with what that particular facility does and great work, and that's not relevant. What's relevant is, what are you going to use additional $20 million for? I don't even have a clue as to what their overall appropriation from the state is. I have no information whatsoever to base my decision on whether or not we should support a $20 million ask on top of a $4 million base appropriation at all. I'm just immensely disappointed. Maybe you could elaborate on what that $20 million would be used for. If you could speak about where other monies come from, are they solely supported by the University of Minnesota? Do they have other outside sources? I haven't seen a balance sheet. I have no idea whatsoever their financial status. So if you could elaborate, please.
Representative Sandsted.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, I had asked to come back and speak following Dr. Weberg's presentation to share that information with you. So if you feel it's appropriate for time, I can do that.
Representative Sandsted, I apologize for that. You did ask for that request, and I did not call back on you. Sorry.
That's okay. I'm going to pull up just a couple of documents right now. One moment. Thank you, Madam Chair. Okay, so first of all, the university does have base funding for NRRI. It's $4.4 million in a state special that they receive, and just a little over $2 million each year that the university allows for O&E expenses, operating and maintenance. So what they are proposing, if there were to be additional monies allotted to them, approximately $5 million would go towards onboard cutting edge technologies and analytic capabilities, things like DNA analysis, trace organics, detection, and I can send this document out to everybody on the committee to see this. $6 million is appropriated for update replacement for infrastructure within the laboratories. As Dr. Weberg pointed out, many of these facilities are pre-Cold War. They have serious concerns with HVAC, asbestos, dust fume control, and safety equipment. So $6 million allotted for that. About $5 million would be used to attract and retain leading research and technical support staff. Right now, there is not enough money within the university system. They're having to borrow from their O&M expenses to go into that. Another $2 million would be used to diversify research program expertise to achieve sustainable development goals. The sustainable development goals are things that have to happen throughout the university, so they have appropriated approximately $2 million for that. Natural resource economics, economic modeling, social science, and stakeholder outreach. And then another $2 million would be dedicated to accelerating commercialization of UMN solutions for Minnesota. So they would be leveraging the Minnesota Launchpad, which works with industry and environment, engage regional and statewide entrepreneur support ecosystems. And then, as I shared, they receive just a little over $2 million a year for operations and maintenance, and then a state special in the amount of about $4.4 million. In order to get the institute running at an optimum level, they are looking in the long run, not today, but for annual support in the amount of approximately $8 million. So we're not there yet. We're working towards it. And this, I realize, is one-time money, but it could be used in just a very beneficial way to kind of build out some of the things that they're already doing. And if they were allotted the full amount, it could be used for a very long time to continue to support. Right now, I think they have about one-third of their staff that is planning on retiring soon. And in order to attract and retain some of these brightest minds, they're going to need additional money, and this could be one way of helping them out. And I'm going through this very quickly, but again, members, I will share this document with you and I'm happy to answer any questions you have.
Okay, Representative Albright, we have 2 minutes for your question and answer, and then we'll move on to Representative Erickson. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First off, I want to congratulate Dr. Weberg. I understand that they just were awarded a $2.1 million research grant by the Department of Energy for expanding their research into steelmaking products. It certainly is a venerable institution. Madam Chair, I have more comment than a question. The IRRRB is also a party to this research function. They give out, I think, on the a neighborhood of $7 to $10 million in grants every year. The possibility is that we might be duplicating some of those efforts. But I also note in Representative Sandstead's elaboration from Representative O'Neill's question about the need for the funding, it seems more likely that this is appropriate as a bonding request via the University of Minnesota, given most of it is for the updating of infrastructure that, as she noted, is dated from the before the Cold War. And my final question, and Representative Sandstead or anyone that's testified can answer, is if the funding was that important, and I don't mean to denigrate the institution, but why wouldn't it also be on the radar for the University of Minnesota, since both Duluth and Coleraine exist because of the connection to the University of Minnesota Duluth campus? Notable that the new president of the college university places an emphasis on that. Why wouldn't they be privy to this and want this to thrive out of their own budget?
Representative Albright, you were mentioning that it was a comment. Was that a rhetorical question or did you want that question answered?
I would Madam like that Chair. Question answered.
Okay, Representative Sandstead.
Thank you, Representative Albright, for that question. And Madam Chair, when we went into this legislative session, I think everyone across the state was expecting that we would be facing deficit spending. And so even when the university came to us with their budget request at the beginning of this legislative session, they have asked for a very bare minimum. This is not their most expensive ask. And so they were keeping it very low. Now, again, as I stated earlier, the university is not, I'm not looking for this to compete with the university budget. In future legislative sessions, hopefully we can increase the base funding for NRRI. I would be very much in favor of doing that. But we do have the opportunity right now for one-time investments that I think the university would be in support of as well. I've actually had this conversation with the university. They would be fully in support of accepting any money to NRRI as long as it's not in competition with what they have asked for in their budget need for this year.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just a couple of requests that NRRI send us a financial statement so we know what other grants they may receive from federal or private. And also, you know, this might be a project that the governor could consider with all that discretionary money he's going to receive from the federal government. Thank you, Madam Chair.
And Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative Sandstead.
Just one very quick point of clarification. Neither of these facilities are actually in my district. Coleraine is in a neighboring district. I just happen to be a fan of the work that they're doing.
Okay, we have, we need to wrap up the questioning now and move on to closing remarks for Representative Sandstead.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Again, my hope is that if there is an opportunity for one-time monies that we could find it appropriate to make an investment in the great work that NRRI is doing. They truly do transformational work and I think they are worthy of this investment. Thank you.
Seeing no further discussion, Representative Sandstead will renew her motion that House File 1895 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Higher Education Finance Omnibus Bill. The bill is laid over. finally, we have House File 2205 from Representative Dabney. I will move House File 2205 to be laid over for possible inclusion. We have before us House File 2205. Representative Dabney, please tell us about your bill and welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the opportunity to present House File 2205 to you and the committee today. I'm pleased to have this bill establishing a direct admissions pilot project. This is an exciting opportunity for Minnesota high school students to recognize the great public post-secondary opportunities to be found right here in their home state, and also for those students to be recognized for their high school achievements. In establishing a direct admissions program, Minnesota would join other states across the country, including Arizona, Florida, Mississippi, Missouri, Montana, Texas, Illinois, Idaho, Colorado, and importantly, our own neighbors of South Dakota and Iowa. Obviously, successfully navigating the transition from high school to whatever post-secondary choice a student makes, a student and their families choose is challenging. We also need to recognize we need more students successfully making that transition for the economy that's emerging. Like many of you, I know this challenge personally, having guided my daughter through her college selection process 3 years ago, a happy gopher today, and being in the midst of it with my high school senior son currently. But being in a white, middle-class, stable, two-parent family with parents who have more college degrees than I care to divulge between the two of us, still made the process maddening, confusing, and uncertain. Now imagine doing that without all of the family assets and experience with the process of college selection, scholarship, and financial aid application. House File 2205 establishes a pilot program in consultation with key stakeholders in both the K-12 and higher education fields. It challenges them to develop and, if feasible, implement a direct admission program and importantly, report back to the legislature on their findings and recommendations just next year. Madam Chair, with me today is Ms. Meredith Fergus from the Office of Higher Education, who can speak to the specifics of the bill.
Thank you, Representative Dabney, and we will move to Ms. Fergus, and we would like to make sure that we have enough time for members' questions. So thank you for being at our hearing today.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. For the record, my name is Meredith Fergus. I am the Director of Research for the Minnesota Office of Education. It's good to see you again today. I was involved in the planning process for the direct admissions proposal, and I'm happy to answer questions. The Office of Higher Education is excited about the proposal, as it is included in the governor's budget as well. We think this is a key kind of change we can make in Minnesota to facilitate the enrollment of low-income students and students of color into our public colleges within the state and really advance the state's attainment goal as well as our equity initiatives. Thank you.
Thank you. And then, members, do we have any questions on the bill? Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Dabney, always looking the sartorial splendiferous that you are.
Thank you, Representative Albright.
Madam Chair, Representative Dabney, I'm just looking at the fiscal impact, $925,000, and I certainly empathize with your situation, having sent three children through higher education and having to have endured the FAFSA debacle that they are. On various occasions, I can certainly empathize with that. But one point, Representative Dabney, in terms of opening up the aperture a little bit with regard to availing individuals, high school students, to an awareness about the opportunity to go to college, I'm struck by the opportunity that might be just prevailing us in the face with regard to not just a letter, but everyone has an iPhone or an Android. How about using some of those fundings to alert people through text or an email to the opportunities and to the supports that already exist. Taking nothing away from the awareness and the approach to make sure that people are aware of how to avail themselves of college, but expedite that possibly in a manner that is more efficient and certainly amenable to what everyone is carrying around in their backpack or in their briefcase.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative Dabney.
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, thank you for the creative ideas. I think it's one thing to tell me, hey, you could go look over here. It's another thing to tell me that I have been admitted tentatively to an institution of higher learning. I think that changes lives and it accomplishes what I think is your goal, if I understand you correctly, of incenting students to follow those links and follow that breadcrumb trail to the sort of opportunity we as a state want and need them to follow.
Representative Albright,
did you have a follow-up? I did. And Representative Downey, a little bit different take on it. I it's a yes and as to a earlier testifier. To make them aware of the opportunities and to where to direct them, not so much to announce that they have been accepted, but before that happens, to open up the aperture and let them know of the accessibility points for help with filling out the FAFSA, help with seeing what accreditation and or standards are necessary to fulfill the obligation and the requirements to enter into college so that they can seek the proper help and not be redundant. And if that's to make an appointment with someone, that would be streamlined in that regard. And just trying to expedite it with the resources and the pipelines that already exist. And maybe we'll find that through this study, but just trying to expedite it, get us into gear faster than through another commission.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this question is for Ms. Fergus. Could you provide us with the link to two or three of these programs? And I don't know if they're pilots in other states, but so that we can do a comparison and a contrast on the Minnesota proposal versus what they've done in other states. Thank you.
Ms. Vergas.
Madam Chair, Representative Erickson, we'd be happy to. The primary program, which launched approximately 4 years ago, is Idaho Direct Admissions. And the immediate result was Idaho students saw a 3 percentage point increase in college going within 1 year of implementation. So that's what we're hoping for here.
Representative Erickson, did you have a follow-up?
Well, Madam Chair, I'm interested in the policies in the legislation that was passed and the funding that was provided, not so much yet in the results, but, you know, just is our process of going about this similar to what other states did, or are we doing something that's far different? Thank you.
Ms. Fergus?
Madam Chair, Representative Erickson, and this also partly in response to Representative Albright's comment. Minnesota does a lot of things well. The one area we actually have not invested in is technology that allows a high school to talk to a college. We rely predominantly on a paper-based system of transcripts, though we may PDF them now and email them. We certainly don't transfer the data in XML format like most other states do. We don't send adequate data to the Minnesota Department of Education for them to produce a transcript. And we don't have concurrent systems across our high schools, districts, and colleges that allow IT alignment in the manner that would really bring down the cost of this proposal dramatically. So some of that is to be expected of the cost, which is built into this fiscal note. And we're hoping that this can serve as a kind of starting point to resolving that misalignment technologically.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you. I see no further hands up. I will turn it back to Representative Dabney for closing remarks.
Madam Chair, thank you, and members of the committee, thank you for your time and attention today. I found Ms. Fergus's most recent comments on our lack of investment in the IT infrastructure that students need for us to support and facilitate them to be powerful. By focusing on low income and BIPOC students finishing high school successfully and helping them transition to post-secondary, we help Minnesota become a richer state. We help it develop to the next generation of Minnesotans. And I believe that's our obligation as a legislature. And I hope for your support for this language moving forward. And I appreciate the time and opportunity to present this bill that I'm very excited about today. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members.
Thank you, Representative Dabney and Ms. Fergus. I will renew my motion that House File 2205 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Higher Education Finance Omnibus Bill. The bill is laid over. Thank you very much for members today for a great conversation, and the meeting is adjourned.